Train Shuffling is brought to you by Midgard Hobbies and Games in Derry, New Hampshire, our friendly local game store. Next, we'd like to thank Luxury Playstyle, maker of fine metal gaming accessories. Visit luxplay.com and use promo code LUXINFORMANT for 15% off. And most importantly, we'd like to thank our lovely patrons for their support. We're super excited that you choose to support us. Your contributions help improve our live streams and bring you better content. If you'd like to buy a few shares of Train Shuffling, you can do so at patreon.com/meekinformant. Enjoy the show! Welcome to Train Shuffling, your podcast about trains and economics and cardboard.
Hey, everyone.
I'm Eric.
I'm Johnny.
And we're your train shufflers, and it's nice to be back. How are you?
I'm great. It is nice to be back. It's only been a week.
Yeah, I know. We're so snappy.
We're going to start cranking these things out.
Good old COVID.
What happens when you can't go anywhere or do anything.
Yep. Unfortunately, we haven't played 18XX since then, but we did play some train games we'll talk about later.
Yeah.
So that's good.
And we'll get one in this week, for sure.
Four, maybe.
I know I will definitely get at least one 18XX in.
You definitely will. I hope I will. I've now altered my work schedule, so everything is crazy. I'm just trying to avoid people. I'm going in to the office like late at night to just try not to see or have to go through anyone else's breathing cloud.
So. Yeah, it's weird because I'm on an off shift and it's starting to get busier because a lot of people are having the same thought. And I think eventually the company's going to have to assign people shifts because everybody's just going to start. Nobody's going to be working for a shift anymore.
Yeah. Well, shall we talk about some trains?
Let's do it. Oh, wait, before we do that, we're still two patrons away for me doing solo streams, even though I'm going to do solo streams anyways, because COVID-19.
We have to pick. So I guess better incentives to actually like incentivize people to do stuff instead of just doing it anyway.
A special case though. I'm going to be doing some solo streams while everybody's stuck at home quarantined, just to try to put some more content out there for people to be entertained by, hopefully.
Yeah. So it's like a preview. This is what you could have.
Yes, exactly.
This could be you. You could be watching this.
A little taste. I mean, when we started Train Shuffling, the original idea, I remember when I asked if you wanted to do this, was do you want to do a six-part mini-series on 18XX? And if it's popular, we'll keep doing it.
So we just started to do it instead.
It was going to be like a goal on Patreon when we were just Board Game Informant. And then, it took off. And now there's no way we'll ever stop doing it.
Never, ever. Cool. Well, look forward to watching some of that. What are you going to solo stream?
It's either going to be Root or Age of Steam because I put it up to the voting patrons and I got one vote for each. So it'll probably be Root because I think it sounds like on Wednesday night we're going to do an Age of Steam stream. Avery and I are in for that and hopefully other people end up being able to join us. But there's plenty of maps for two players and any player count really with that game. So,
how do you play solo Root? Is there a solo game?
Yeah. So it originally came with a mechanical marquee, and then I can't remember what it's called, but it's like the Better Bot Project or something like that. So they revamped it. So I think all of the original factions and maybe even a couple more have their own Automa.
And Better Bot Project.
They revamped the original mechanical marquee, and then they created bots for a bunch of other factions. So you can play solo. You can also play two players and then play against bots. And I think it more closely mimics like a multiplayer game than the original bot did. So I haven't done it yet. So I can't really say too much about it, but it's supposed to be pretty good.
Cool. Done with that.
And I love the multiplayer game, so I'm hoping that the solo game is fun also.
Yeah. All right. So look forward to that. And if you like it, you listener, then become a patron if you're not, and you'll get more of it.
Do you think Nicholas is listening to this?
I was thinking about Nicholas the other day. Nicholas is our disembodied, like, generic listener that we named Nicholas at some point on the other podcast. The other podcast, Meek Informant, for those of you crack addict L5R players like me. Okay, So let's move on to the private auction. Let's do some housekeeping. We actually have a little bit of this week. I guess first, just general announcement. Doesn't need to be said, I hope, but it's not a correction, but just, you know, stay safe. COVID-19 is all over the world, and we're all just trying to flatten the curve and slow it down and get rid of it. So do that. Stay home. Don't cheat. Don't go like, oh, we'll just go have this one little party or something. That's how it keeps going. Okay, enough mothering.
Yep, enough about that. So last week, I sort of disparaged the United States Postal Service for stealing, quote unquote, I said I was joking at the time, and I was, stealing the poker chips out of the envelopes that I sent to backers. And Len actually said he knows exactly what happened. Apparently, if there's like a bump inside of an envelope and it's not flat enough to go through their scanning machines, you need to put a special stamp on it that says it's non-machinable, and it costs more, but it prevents it from having issues. So it was my fault for not knowing that, and I need to get non-machinable surcharge stamps and then resend them. But apparently at least one person got their poker chips, so somehow at least one of them made it through.
Yeah.
So I'll be reaching out to everyone, and I'll find out if anybody else got theirs and make sure I know who needs another one.
Did you issue a statement of apology to the U.S. Postal Service?
I didn't, but I'm going to host a press conference.
Okay. We've had enough of those lately. So we also, speaking of missing things, we missed Randy's answer to last week's question, which was, the question about common mistakes made by beginners in games that, you know, maybe you could help them avoid making those mistakes. And he says, assuming after a player few that there is a dominant strategy in a given 18XX title. So basically kind of jumping to conclusions, saying, this is how you win this game and I've solved it. That may be the case in some games, but very few. There's a reason that we keep coming back to play these games. It's not out of nostalgia or love of railroading history, at least not for me. If a game is still regularly getting played by a group of smart people, there's probably a good reason for it. This is not to say that your opinion of certain titles is wrong. There are a lot of ways to enjoy an 18XX game, and some titles will appear to appeal to some and turn off others. Sorry. However, it seems pretty common for newer players to state their opinion as facts, ignoring a large body of hobbyists who hold a different opinion. So, let it be known.
I actually have a response to that. Talked about this offline as well, but we actually talked about making this a main topic of one of our episodes a while back, because we'd heard that there was a game where somebody said there is absolutely one dominant strategy, and if you do this, you're guaranteed to win. And we had an inherent problem with that line of thinking, in that if there's a dominant strategy in a game, then if one person does it, why wouldn't everybody do it? Or is it, you know, like, it doesn't seem to make sense. Like Randy says, in most cases, they're really, these games, the framework of 18XX doesn't really allow for dominant strategies in most of the titles. So that also bothers me when somebody says that, and I'm not as experienced as Randy.
Yeah, I think that generally, right, if something that came up in that part of that conversation is, if that strategy is the thing that is, you know, it's very strong in the game, then it, after at least a couple of plays, hopefully if you're playing with the same people, they would catch on to that and they would, as a group, prevent you from doing it. We can maybe dive into that deeper in a future episode. But I think what you said, that this game framework does a good job of allowing, it's like ebbs and flows. You have to win by inches before you win by miles. And what I mean by that, I guess, is that if a strategy is too strong, then the table can correct it, can self-correct. I don't know if that really came out the same way as what I meant it, but yeah, I don't know.
Sounded good.
So that's all of our private auction. We can move on to our initial stock round, where we talk about listener questions from last week's question, which is, What percentage of your gaming time is dedicated to 18XX, and how much game time do you get per month? If you play non-18XX games, 19XX, nice. What are your favorite titles? So Scott Smith from St. Louis said that he plays less than 5% of his 30 to 40 hours per month of game time is 18XX, unfortunately, because most of his gaming buds are Euro-playing Care Bears who are scared of 18XX. St. Louis is great for gamers, multiple board game meetups every day. Miniature Market is their local, friendly local game store. And there's multiple conventions in town because of that. And their favorite game, or his favorite game? His favorite game is City of the Big Shoulders, which he uses as a teaser to try and lure people into 18XX. So that's a pretty recent one. We actually have yet to play that, but we've got a copy that we've got to give a try soon to City of the Big Shoulders. He also really likes Brass Birmingham and Teotihuacan.
Teotihuacan.
He also games at home with his wife, who likes 18XX with friends, but hates it with strangers. And so he's excited for 18 Chesapeake to play two-player with his wife. I like that. Hates it with strangers. That's interesting.
Yeah. What are the odds you get Allie to play that with you?
0%. 1%, maybe.
Pretty low.
It would be like...
I think your answer was 0%.
When we're on like month 6 of lockdown and our kids have learned to go play nicely by themselves for 9 hours and she doesn't want to sleep anymore.
If she completely runs out of things to do, you're going to catch her listening to Train Shuffling.
Yeah, it's going to be awesome.
All right. So John Galt also responded. He said he's lucky if he's able to play 18XX face-to-face more than twice per year. He's thankful for play-by-email zines. Like, I don't know how to pronounce that. Can you do that?
Nope. Let's try. Oh, no. Should we? Manesepalaga? Nope.
Better than what I would have done.
That's terrible. That's awful. I'm sorry, everyone who speaks French.
So anyways, moving on. So 18XX is about 5% of his gaming time. He plays lots of Euro games locally because that's what's played around there. And also other play-by-email games like Diplomacy and Paths of Glory. And also online Bridge at bridgebase.com, which he recommends for all skill levels.
Speaking of card games, if we edit this fast enough and get it out there, there is an app called Cribbage with Grandpas, or yeah, I think it's Cribbage with Grandpas, that is normally like $3 on the where is it, until March, no, not that app, until March 23rd. Cribbage with Grandpas is free, and it's like a game where you can play cribbage on your phone against a little like grandpa avatar who you can make look like how you want to make and then give it a personality, I guess, or something. I don't know. I haven't played it yet, but I downloaded it, and if it sucks, I'll delete it. But I don't know. If you play like cribbage, give it a try. So Shazner responded. He said gaming has slowed due to COVID-19. Understandable. But he plays about once a week, almost exclusively plays 18XX. So usually mid to short length titles, and that they call games sometimes when there's a clear winner. And when not playing 18XX, he plays 18XX-ish games with player-driven economies. For example, I guess recently he played Tokyo Tsukiji Market from Jordan Draper and quite liked it. Oof, doing good with words.
I have not tried that one, but I do very much enjoy Import Export by Jordan.
Yeah, that's when is that going to get fulfilled? I wonder.
I think it was supposed to be like around May or June or something this year.
Cool.
I don't know if that's been delayed with...
Yeah, every fulfillment of every Kickstarter and all that stuff is all just kind of like question mark for a bit.
Yeah.
We'll see. If the world doesn't end, then eventually.
So Eric Brogius plays about 600 games a year. About 75 of those are 18XX. 25% of his game playing time is spent playing 18XX. So about 750 total hours of game time and 200 hours of 18XX per year, nearly half of which are 1846.
My man.
No surprise there.
Yeah.
That's a lot of 1846.
It is a lot, yeah. Yeah, something to be said for the simple pleasures of just hammering on a game, whether or not it's 46 or not. But yeah. I've been getting more and more into Arkham Horror sitting here, the card game, with, you know, playing with my wife or playing online or solo or at my table here. It's like 50 card games of that, and it just starts to get, it's a nice repetitive thing. I don't know. Simple pleasures. JC Lawrence also responded to our question and said, at best, he plays about 70 to 80 18XX games per year. He says he tries to spend about 2 hours of reflection / analysis time for each hour played. And until recently, he was on track for about 120 plays this year, which he felt was too much to be comfortable with. But now things have slowed down. So he's actually happier to be playing fewer games. So he has more time to spend thinking about them.
Yeah, 120 plays. I mean, that's two a week. That's
insane. A lot.
Well, it's more than two a week.
Yeah, yeah, more than 2 a week. I mean, it sounds like his group will play more than one game a night.
And they'll call a game if there's a clear loser. So I imagine some of their games are probably called in the first 20 or 30 minutes. So
yeah, yeah.
They could play four games in a night or something.
I see his posts a lot in the On Your Table channel in Slack. And generally, it sounds like they get about two games in a night.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's go on to Laying Track, shall we?
Yeah. So we got a big news item.
It is a big... I was super excited when I saw this.
Yeah. So, of course, we're talking about 1833 New England, the title formerly known as 1834.
1833 NE. So this is pretty exciting. I was actually in contact with Tom Lehman, the designer of 1833 New England, 1834.
Race for the Galaxy.
Race for the Galaxy, 1846. A number of other titles. I think Space Merchants or something is one of them. He's got a lot of games that he's designed. I'm not familiar with many of them, but you know, Race for the Galaxy, 46, and this one. Big fans of all those games. And so I was actually asking him what is okay for us to talk about mechanically, because I actually got a chance to play this game. We talked about it on a previous podcast. But was asked to not, you know, talk about specific mechanics because it's not out yet. It's actually still being actively worked, from the sounds of it. When I talked to him today on BGG, he said that they had just recently made some changes to like the number of, well, some just like basic balance things between companies, that they're still working through. So we don't want to go ahead and talk about specific mechanics when they're not correct. So anyway, I wanted to give a general overview of the game at a high level so that people can get an idea, a little bit of it, because we want to, I really want more people to go back this on the P500 so we get it sooner. So anyway, the main way that the game functions is very similar to 1846. It's an incremental cap game. It's got a 1D stock market. You can do the double, triple jumping thing where, like in 46, once you're out of that little box, you can triple jump based on your payout. You can do half payouts or half caps, whatever you want to call them, half withholds. You can issue and redeem shares like in 46. You can pay for up to two tile lays per turn. So in essence, it builds on the foundation that 46 laid out financially, like that basic framework. There's actually a private auction in this game. I think I'm remembering this correctly. It's been a bit, but I'm pretty sure there was a 1830 style private auction instead of the draft. There are a lot of different interconnection bonuses between different destinations. Instead of like in 46, there is an east to west bonus period. There's, I guess, in that game with in 46, is there different east west bonuses or just one? Is it just one east west bonus?
There's multiple. So I think the amount of the bonus is dependent on
where you go, right?
Where you go. Like each offboard has a bonus. So you get whatever combination of offboard bonuses from your east-west run.
Yeah. I'm like pulling up the map.
It's like two of them added together. So if you hit a 50 and a 40 offboard.
Right. But it is, yeah. Bonus, you get 90. Yes. Right. So it's plus 50 on the west for Chicago and plus 20 for the southern one down near where the X starts. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So this game,
instead of just east to west, there are, you know, Boston to Montreal or whatever, and New York to wherever. There's a lot of them, and on the GMT website, you can go and see the board on the P500 page, and you can see all these little arrows that have a lot of different bonuses. So there's a lot of that. It's pretty cool. They change throughout the game, so bonuses between two connections might give you more early game versus late game, which I feel like feels like 1880 a little bit, with the offboards that change and drop in value for a little while and come back up. It sort of felt like that a bit to me. And they, to some extent, modeled the demand of business and travel according to the history of that time, which is kind of neat. There are new and unique private companies, which I'm not going to go into detail about, mostly because I don't remember most of them. I remember the one that I got, and I forget everybody else's. There are ferries in the game, which add bonuses onto your routes down in the area between Long Island, the Long Island Sound and Cape Cod, so down on the little coast area of Connecticut and New York. And unlike 46, there are dits in this title, but mostly around Boston and the southern coast, where it's more congested. And the trains, like 46, have an M/M train, so like a 4-6 or something, just like in 46. But on the other side, instead of a solid number, it's an N+M train, so, you know, 2+2, where you can do cities and dits. There's also a more advanced version of the game that I didn't get to play called the Takeover game, which I'm pretty excited about trying. But it, in that, as the name suggests, you can take over other people's companies. And that's all I really can recall about the rules of that one.
Yeah, so, it looks like from the board that takeovers also initiate like train exports. So the train rush seems to accelerate when takeovers are occurring. If I'm understanding the text on the right side, it says like, when a takeover happens, remove a phase 4 train from the deck or something like that.
Okay. Yeah. I literally have no memory of like Eric gave us a whole rule rundown of the takeover rules after we finished the standard game. And I promptly forgot all of it. So I don't remember, but I can say that the game, I think we played in about 4 hours, four and a half hours, for a 4-player game. It was really good. I liked it a lot. I like the system of 46, so I will say that I like 46. And this took that and then built a bunch of chrome up on top of it. And it felt like a really cool puzzle to try and figure out, like, how do I make this company work or these? Because they all felt fairly different. The ones that are more congested down in the south have to fight with each other for tokens, whereas the ones up in the north don't, but they aren't near a lot of the good money. And they apparently can work, but I don't know how. I think those are probably part of what's being balanced right now. Some of that stuff's being worked out. So,
yeah, I think one of the most interesting things to me about it is that it's, it's a very narrow corridor coming, from, Rhode Island, Connecticut, up through, Massachusetts into New Hampshire, Vermont. Obviously, Maine is off to the side there, and there's only the southern portion of Maine included, but it's a very narrow corridor, but there's a lot of these destinations that you're trying to connect, or these offboards that you're trying to connect. So I think the idea of those intermediate connections, where if you do end up getting tokened out, which probably, it seems like something that's going to happen a lot, you can still get like a partial bonus for transporting your passengers, part of the way. And I think that's really cool.
Hey everyone, jumping forward in time here. This is Eric, the morning after we recorded this episode. I went over some points here in the episode about 1834 that I had written up based on my experiences, and I sent them along to Tom Lehman, and he actually responded back with quite a detailed answer for most of the questions. So I figured I would just record what I wrote down and then what his response was to each of them. And I'm inserting that into the episode in post here. So you'll hear me talk about all this stuff, and then we'll hop back to the previously recorded episode. So first of all, the main way the game functions financially is very similar to 1846. It's an incremental cap game. It's got a 1D stock market. it's got double and triple jumping based on payouts. You know, once you're outside of that box, you can get a triple jump in your stock value. There's half capping, your revenue. There's issuing and redeeming shares. You can pay up for 2 tile lays per turn. In essence, it builds upon the foundation that 46 laid out. Tom's response was, yeah, correct. The OR sequence is the same as 1846. Combined track plus tile, track plus token step, privates can be bought in at any time, etc. A quick start summary will be provided for 1846 players covering the rules differences. The private auctions, dot cities and N plus M trains, ferries, plus direct and interconnection bonuses. So we'll talk about some of those things you just talked about coming up here. The second point, I just said that there's an actual private auction in this game instead of just a draft for private companies. This is similar to 1830 style auctions. He said, correct, 1833 NE is geared towards intermediate to advanced players. The third point was that there are a lot of different interconnection bonuses that change throughout the game, which to some extent model the demand of business and travel according to the history of that time. So Tom's response, this is where I really like this stuff. He said, correct, it models the regional nature of New England railroading. Historically, in 1830, Boston dominated New York City as an industrial region and as a port to Europe with its half-day shipping advantage. However, the Erie Canal, which gave New York Central, not New York Central, NYC, access to the rapidly developing American Midwest via the Great Lakes, threatened this. And if you hang on and listen through the rest of the show, you'll hear me talk about the Erie Canal and New York Central's connection to the Great Lakes. In the game, there's a small window where Boston attempts to connect to the Erie Canal at Albany with a large bonus for doing so. Then the Boston merchants attempt to outflank it via Ogdensburg, a small upstate New York port with access to the Great Lakes in Montreal, which coincided with Montreal's push for access to a warm water port, initially either Portland, Maine, or Boston. By the game's third act, NYC has triumphed, and the bonuses are primarily for connecting to it. In game terms, this is modeled by both direct connection bonuses. A train runs the entire route, so like the east to west connections in 46, and interconnection bonuses. A train runs part of a route along the track that extends to the destination, representing freight interchange. This bonus can be quite large and enter, play, and go away as new phases occur. Thus, a given railroad can be extremely lucrative for just a brief period. This produces a feeling of being whipsawed by exterior events, different from most 18XX games, which reflect the reality of New England railroading. And I can attest that this is how that felt in the game. This also strongly encourages stock cross investment. A player who is setting up a railroad for a huge mid-game bonus needs to cross-invest in a railroad that is earning large bonuses during the early rounds, or they'll fall too far behind in capital and stock shares. Similarly, a player whose railroad is initially wealthy needs to invest in railroads that will be lucrative later on. They can't just rest on their laurels. So the fourth point, I said that there are new and unique privates, which I won't talk about specifically, mostly because I can't remember a lot of them. I remember the one that I got. Tom said that the privates represent various historical activities. They aren't particularly unique in 18XX terms. There was a couple that were pretty neat. But I guess we'll just wait to see what those are. Fifth point, there are ferries which add bonuses onto your routes down in the area between Long Island Sound and Cape Cod. Tom said, ferry routes must interconnect to Boston and represent passenger traffic between Boston and NYC before better bridge technology allowed for a fast, efficient way to travel by rail between these cities. They were the quote business travel of this age and a source of fierce rivalry. This rivalry is represented by an extra bonus counter that keeps moving to the latest ferry to be built. The Cape Cod Ferry is not part of these rival ferries and is a permanent representing service to the Cape's islands. So whoever builds the last one gets a little bonus marker that will get pulled off for like, now I'm the newest, I'm the latest and newest and greatest fairy company, until someone else builds another one and upsets that. 6 point, unlike 46, there are dits in this title, mostly around Boston and the Southern Coast. Tom says, unlike most 18XX games, the 1833 NE dot cities improve in value as they're upgraded, making N plus M trains quite attractive. Historically, the Boston City Fathers subsidized commuter traffic by tariffs on freight. Just before World War I, Boston had more passenger traffic than either London or Paris. Even today, there is substantial commuter train traffic into Boston from its outlying communities. Can attest. 7th point, trains are N plus M, N slash M trains or N plus M trains in this game. So like in 46, it's either N slash M, so like a 4/6 train, or on the other side, it's a 3 train, 4 train, 5 train. I don't know which ones go to with which off the top of my head. It's a single number on the other side. And in this game, on the other side, there are the N plus M, so like a 2+2 train, that pick up dits, just like in another game, two cities and two dits in that case. 8th point and final, there is a more advanced version of the game called the Takeover game, which I haven't played, but you know, you can take over other people's company. So here, Tom's description of that. Correct. The two dominant railroads in New England, the New York, New Haven, and Hartford, and the Boston and Maine, grew by takeovers, not mergers, in quite different ways. The NYNHNH was J.P. Morgan's railroad, and it grew by financial takeovers of successful railroads. The Boston and Maine, by contrast, grew by acquiring low-valued bankrupt railroads for a pittance. The takeover mechanism allows for both of these methods. Essentially, one railroad can buy out another railroad that is connected to it by paying for each of its issued shares from its treasury, giving the owner either cash or a share of the railroad doing the takeover as its president wishes. Typically, the president gives shares for its own shares and money for the other player's shares. So if you're taking over one of your own companies, is that the former? In the takeover game, train limits are reduced to just one in the later phases, which limits a railroad's flexibility. Each successful takeover increases a railroad's train limit by one, as it was, as well as giving it the tokens of the railroad being taken over. So a player can start the NYNHNH at $150 per share, capitalize it, and then buy out a successful railroad with the president's president's consent using its cash. Or a player with the B&M can start a railroad at $40 with minimal shares, lay a bit of useful track, let it buy a train for a dollar, and then have the B&M take it over for a pittance, gaining the tokens and increasing its train limit. The takeover game adds 5 parachute railroads for a total of 14 railroads. This greatly increases variety. I designed and developed 1833 NE before 1846. I hope the players will enjoy exploring it. So thanks for the detailed write-up, Tom. It's really exciting stuff. I am very excited to try the takeover game and to just explore this title more, because with one play, it was just enough to give a taste. So, okay, now we're going to jump back in time to the previously recorded episode. Yeah, so that's 1833 NE. I'm going to have to get used to that one. And it looks like right now, as of the time of recording for this, what is it? 1833 NE. I think it was like 530 people had, 546 had, have ordered it on GMT. Apparently right around the 900 number mark is when it's like definitely going to get printed. So keep those numbers rolling in, people. Let's make it happen. Fastest 18XX P500 ever.
Yeah, let's do it. I'm excited for this one to come out. So everybody, make it happen.
Cool. Shall we continue?
Yeah, let's lay some tokens.
Okay.
Mine. What's happened in 1861.
I think actually everyone's waiting on me right now. So I don't know. Since we've recorded, I think other people have taken turns, but not me. So now I've been holding it up for 2 days as I have. I'm definitely not innocent in this whole thing, by the way, if I've implied that. Every single player in this game, I think, besides like maybe one guy or two guys, maybe just 3 guys, are taking a long time.
Well, there's only 4 of you.
Is there four? I don't even remember if there's four.
Because there were five of us.
Oh, you were the fifth and you were going, yeah. Okay. So yeah, that and the 1830 podcast game that we're playing on RR18XX, we're like getting, I think we're just about done with SR5.
Yeah.
I bought some shares.
I put myself on auto pass just because I don't want to extend it, even if somebody does something crazy.
Yeah. So that's what's happening online?
Yeah. For me? I'll be honest, these asynchronous online games are getting tiring to me because they take so long that you don't even remember what's happened. And it doesn't feel very strategic, which is what I like most about 18XX. I don't feel like it's really feasible to make long-term strategies in these asynchronous games when they take 6 months to play.
Yeah.
Without a lot more, expending a lot more mental energy to try to get yourself back up to speed every time your turn comes back around a month later or whatever, you know?
Yeah, I think that, you know, this length of an online play is not typical, hopefully. Like, I totally agree. I can't play it. You know, every time it's my turn, I'm like, ugh, I dread it. I'm like, what the hell was I doing again? And that's why it takes so long. But I agree in general. I actually have been asked a bunch of times about playing asynchronous games online lately. And I just said no, because, I don't need any more of that right now. I'd love to just find some time and play synchronously online.
Yeah.
So that's what we're trying to do more of.
Yep. I am doing one other asynchronous game online, which is 1862 with Randy and a couple of other people that I don't know. And it's going pretty quickly. There were a couple delays. Randy went away for a weekend, and so there was a delay for that. And then I think it was on me for a couple days while I was busy with work. And but we've been moving pretty quickly, and we went through like four ranks of trains in one OR, and only half the companies have operated so far. So the game's very close to being over.
Cool.
And that's been a pretty interesting game.
So. Yeah, I want to get 62 played again. We have a lot of titles building up.
Yeah.
So we streamed Irish Gauge and Chicago Express this past Wednesday on Tabletop Simulator, which was pretty fun, I got to say. I was a little worried that Tabletop Simulator and my laptop weren't going to be happy being friends, but they were friends. And the interface kind of got out of the way for me. I don't know how you felt about it, Johnny, but it was it felt like playing a game with people.
Yeah, I think there was definitely a little bit more pressure being the screen that was streamed to not move around the table much or zoom in on things, which I'll talk a little bit more when we get to Chicago Express, because it was a little more of a problem with that than it was with Irish Gauge. But for the most part, yeah, no, I think it does get out of your way for the most part.
Yeah. It's, you know, in times like these, it is an amazing tool that's helping a lot of people maintain like regular, some degree of normalcy, right? And actually play board games with friends. So nothing but praises from me.
Yep. So what'd you think of Irish Gauge?
So that was like my third or fourth play of Irish Gauge. One, two, three, four. Yeah, I think it was my fourth play. Had a wonderful time. It was cool to play with XX players who have a much deeper understanding of shared incentive games than a lot of the people that I've played this with so far. And I know I lost. I think Randy won. Did Randy
win? I won.
You won. I think I've done that twice now, huh? Or no. Oh, I thought Dave. Yeah, Dave came in second. Right. Yes. You won. Dave came in second. And then
Dave tied for second.
Oh, right. They had like 108 each or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was cool. I love that game. I will very rarely ever say no to Irish Gauge. I think a lot of these types of games, it's possible to find yourself three quarters of the way through the game going, I cannot win, and like recognizing that. But that's not something that bothers me, especially in an hour-long game. that, you know, and even with like 6 hour games, I've found myself in that position. And it's interesting to think about like, how did I get here and why did that person get to where they are? And Irish Gauge has a, you know, it's got a random factor with the cubes, but it is something that you can plan for. And if you understand probability.
Yeah, exactly. So the designer posted on BoardGameGeek in response to the question about randomization, and he posted that it was his intent wasn't to top a game like Chicago Express, which may not be possible. It was to explore probabilities. So he didn't really like the term randomness applied to it, because while it is, I guess, somewhat random, you, like you said, you can plan for it. I know that if there's 5 black cubes and 3 pink and 3 white, that the odds are that a black cube is going to come up when I draw 3.
Right. And it's not about an individual draw either. It's planning for a known, right? Eventually, all of these tokens are coming out of the bag. So maybe when you draw, against all odds, you don't get the cube you're looking for. But that just means that the odds are even higher that it's going to come up next round.
Right.
Right. So
yeah, and you can pull like the last cube of a color out as a special interest cube to guarantee that somebody doesn't get that final payout where they've built a route with a bunch of that color cube in it.
Right.
So I think that Irish Gauge has a really good balance of strategic depth and accessibility. Like, it's certainly not the deepest of the cube rails games, but it is so quick to teach. Every time I've taught it, it's taken about 5 minutes and people get it. They might not be
good
at it.
Yeah.
But they understand everything that you're supposed to do. They just don't really know the best way to go about it. And I've never had a game take more than 45 minutes, including the teach. So it's certainly the most accessible of the three that I've played. And even though it may not be as deep as Chicago Express or German Railways, I think that it's deep enough to still provide a lot of enjoyment.
Yeah, I love it. It's good.
So it's the one I've enjoyed the most so far, but I have a feeling that over time that may shift to some of the deeper ones.
Such as
Chicago Express.
Chicago Express.
Yeah, so my thoughts on Chicago Express is it's actually, so I've only played it twice, and I had a bit of a problem with it on Tabletop Simulator. So I alluded to it earlier. The graphics quality wasn't so great, and there's so much uniqueness to some of the hexes, like whether it's a +1 or a +2. And it was really hard to parse on Tabletop Simulator without zooming in on hexes, which I was trying not to do too much because of the fact that it was my screen that everybody was seeing. So I was trying to show the whole game to everybody for most of the time. So I had a little bit of a problem just reading the map. So yeah. I think in person or either playing it in person or having much more experience with it, so that way I kind of know where things are, would have helped a lot in that game.
So I think honestly that game, that production, which is a digital representation of the Queen Games production of Chicago Express, it suffers from that thing that 18XX players love to gripe about, is that like they made it prettier than the original was called Wabash Cannonball. That is just, you know, hexes. It's just plain hexes and cubes on the map. But the information was probably a lot clearer on that one than this version. And I think that this game could really use a good graphics overhaul or an underhaul to simplify things and take it more in the style of Irish Gauge. I'm sure that information can be conveyed much clearer and actually still probably look better. I like simpler designs.
Yeah. And German Railways, it was also done by Queen Games, and they also use the textured landscape and stuff. And I actually prefer some of the redraws that have been done that are just simple colors, more like Irish Gauge type style. But in that game, there's very few unique hexes, and when they are, it's like a big red number saying that it's worth 2 or 3 instead of 1. So it's got that artistic style, but it's still much easier to parse. So of the three that I've played, Chicago Express is definitely the hardest map to read.
Yeah, agreed.
To play that on a different map, which we can probably, I bet there's probably one available to print. We could just do that.
Yeah, there might be one on BGG for Wabash Cannonball, the original version of the game. I don't know if anything else got tweaked when they got it from, it was a Winsome originally.
Right. And we have the Laminator, so we could make a fairly nice replacement. I was actually thinking about doing that with German Railways too, although that one's really not that hard to read, but there's a couple really nice print and play versions. So yeah. So anyways, besides that, I think that there's a lot of potential, and I have a feeling that I will like that game a lot more. The more I play it, the more I become familiar with it. But so far, my experiences with that, it's been my least favorite so far, just because of the circumstances surrounding both of the plays and just not really having a chance to dive as deep into it as I would like to.
I personally prefer Chicago Express to Irish Gauge, given the choice. The timing, you know, how long the game takes is, I think, negligible. It's like 45 minutes versus an hour and 20. I don't care about that. The game, so let's see, what are some of the things that I like about this more than Irish Gauge? I like that there is some like, it's not randomness, it is player generated chaos in that you can't control what other players are going to do as far as like which actions, which dials are going to increase. So you can't exactly be sure of the timing of a payout until it's very close. And even then you can't exactly be sure of when a dividend phase is going to trigger. So you have to be playing and predicting your other players. I love the three dial thing where a payout is coming and it's going to come. You can't just, you know, in Irish Gauge, everyone can just build, and then someone can call a thing. And that's not something that's, you know, with experience, people won't do that, I don't think. But it can lead to some like this very long buildup, and then all of a sudden a dividend phase happens. Where in this game, every once in a while, one's happening. It's going to happen. It's like, you know, time is marching on. You're always going to get a dividend phase. I like that the companies have to pay their way through difficult terrain. So like if you overbid for something, it's not the worst. But in this game, it's, you know, your shares aren't worth anything at the end of the game. So that I find interesting too. I don't know. I don't want to get too deep into it, but I'm a fan of Chicago Express. I love both these games, honestly. But given the choice, I think Chicago Express it ekes out the favorite for me a little bit.
Yeah. Cool. And while we're on the subject of Cube Rails, and you haven't played it, but I did manage to play a game of German Railways or Preußische Ostbahn.
Very nice. Good job.
So I have some mixed feelings about it because it was a lot of fun and there were a lot of interesting things about it. But the game sort of went sideways at one point where a player didn't really understand that he was putting up a share for auction without being able to win it. And there was only one person who could win it and not really even overspend on it. And then immediately use his next action to connect two railways, which causes a dividend phase. And whoever causes the connection gets double dividends. And the game just kind of spiraled out of control for this player. And it was about two thirds of the way into it. So the last third of the game was fairly uninteresting. But there was, you know, just looking past that specific play into some of the mechanisms, I think it's a really, really interesting game. And I like that different companies have different powers, and I think that the action draw mechanism, where if you're not familiar with it, basically in income order, so lowest to highest, you get to put a number of discs equal to the player count, and then the next person gets player count minus one until the player who's in the lead gets one disc in, and you put all these discs in a bag, and then you draw a number of discs equal to the number of players. So there's a potential that if you're in the lead, you may not get an action in the following round. So almost like a balancing mechanism. And those statistics change based on player count. So I'm curious if the game, I haven't really done enough research to know if the game is better or worse at higher or lower player counts. So I'm curious about that, but I think this game does a lot of really interesting things, and I'm eager to play it again and kind of see with a little more experience what this game can be.
Cool. Yeah, I'm looking forward to trying it. I don't know anything about it. I haven't even kind of looked into it. Yeah, so if you, listener, have any recommendations for good Cube Rails games, especially anything that happens to be on Tabletop Simulator, although that's, I think we've pretty much exhausted those. I don't, maybe there's some hiding in the wings somewhere, but send them our way. We'd love to hear about them because they are fantastic little substitutes for 18xx, but you know, I think that the audiences have a fair amount of crossover, and we definitely like both of them. So so you want to run some trains?
Yeah, let's do it. So our main topic today is financing. So we thought it would be interesting to do not a specific game strategy nor a deep dive into strategy, but just something to things that we've started thinking about a little more deeply now that we've played more games, and things that we think if anybody's, you know, listening to us because they're kind of on the same path as we are, where we're still relatively new, but we're starting to elevate our thinking in these games, that we would just provide some thoughts that we've had about different aspects of 18xx. So today we want to talk about finances.
It sounds riveting.
I know, right? Well, I mean, it's the games are spreadsheets, right?
It's true.
So, so I guess the first thing is the obvious thing, which is the different capitalization schemes. So those are obviously very important. And I think before we even talk about capitalization schemes, I think that one of the most important things that you need to think about, which is heavily tied to it, is how you're going to be getting your permanent trains. Because obviously this is a game about assets and liabilities. And every time you are president of a company, you have the liability of a company that may or may not have a train in it. So thinking about how you're going to get that permanent train that will never rust into that company and avoid, you know, having to emergency fundraise or go bank or emergency finance or go bankrupt is one of the things that you should be thinking about right from the beginning of the game.
And a good route to run it on, probably, which can be two things that are in contention with each other. I need money to token that critical spot, but I need that money also to buy that permanent train before it's gone. Oh no, what do I do? You lose the game. That's what you do when you're me. So.
Yeah, and both of us usually, because we're playing with people with decades of experience on us.
Yeah.
But yeah, so capitalization schemes. So there's kind of two in a broad category, I think, at least from my perspective. There's full capitalization, incremental cap, and partial cap. So I'll just run through what they mean and a couple of considerations for each of them. So full capitalization, you get 100% of the money when the company floats. So that usually happens when 50 or 60% of the shares are bought. So if you par a company at $100 and you spend $600, if it requires 60%, the company floats and it gets $1,000. So you get free money. Or as Tony likes to say for the 50% games, money for half off.
Sale for half off, yeah.
Full cap is interesting because you get free money early in the game, which helps you purchase your initial trains. So you can start earning dividends and all that fun stuff. Because we like to run our trains in pair divs. So A couple of things that I've been thinking about with full cap is, you know, what are some of the implications of that? So when you start your first company, you have to kind of consider some of the aspects of the game, whether they're present or not. So one important thing is, is the company able to buy private companies from players? Because if they can, then you not only need to consider the money that you need to capitalize in order to buy your initial trains, but you also want to be able to loot that company. So you want to make sure you par it high enough to be able to get money out of it and put trains into the company. So that's one thing that I think is important to think about.
Or have some other plan for the company so that you don't need to get trains into it, like pawning it off on somebody else or never connecting it or things like that.
Right. Yeah. If you're able to briefcase, it's probably not something you're gonna do with your first company, but yeah, later on in the game, you might think about if you can get free money without having to take on additional liabilities. So that's where I think you get into, even though you're just starting the game, you start thinking about, well, how are you going to finance your permanent train? So you know that you're easily going to be able to buy your twos and your threes right out of the gate.
And what's interesting for me about this decision is that it's heavily dependent on what other people do and where your turn order is, right? If you are staring at a bunch of even maybe not just permanent trains, but what initial trains am I going to get? And what is my first route going to look like? And when am I going to operate? So this question of what am I going to par my full cap company at to get the money I need, the implication that might fall out of that is that you operate either first or second or third or last or whatever. And by that time, based on what you part at and what everyone else part at, if you're predicting that they'll part at a certain value, now a whole bunch of stuff has happened just because of what value you set the company at, let alone what you were planning to do with the money.
Right.
So it's like this crazy juggling act. There's like six plates in the air that you're trying to, you know, keep spinning on the very first decision of the game in general. Well, not the very first decision of a company.
Yeah. And I think it brings up an important point that all of these things that we're thinking about, we're not diving so deep into the weeds where we're going to think about this if you're going to be operating first, or this if you're going to be operating second or third, or it's, you know, all those different, these are all very nuanced decisions. So treat this discussion as a high level thing to think about, because any of these considerations could change depending on a multitude of factors, including factors that may only be present in some titles and not others. So, but speaking of par pricing, so in a full cap game, it's really common to start your first company low and your later companies high. And it makes sense because in your first company, there's not a whole lot of benefit to parring really high. And what I mean by that is you're likely not going to be able to par your company high enough that you can afford your early trains and your late trains with the same money. So you don't necessarily want to put extra money into that company that you could have used to purchase more shares. So you start low because you want to be able to start buying your initial trains and you want to be able to get private company money out of that company so you can buy more shares. So you're trying to probably look for a par value where you are just putting enough in to do that and not any excess.
You're not looking to put all your eggs in one basket, right? You want to keep some of your money working for you in shares, but liquid because it's not your company. Potentially it's someone else's company that maybe you can sell those shares and then, or sell your first company down to the Bear presidency potentially and then start something else. If you're talking about an 1830 style game. So I think that's, right. You know, just me trying to put a different spin on what you were saying.
Yep. Yeah. And so that's some of the things that you want to think about when you're parring that is what your plans are for that company and not just saying, well, I came out of that private auction with $500 and I can now par this company at $100 and buy 5 shares. Cause that might not be the right move. You might not really want $1,000 in that first company right away. Because now you've tied up all your money in the company money and you're probably not earning a lot of dividends and, early money in your hands, not your company hands is better than, well, not better than late game money, but it turns into more money later because that money can be utilized to purchase shares, which will pay dividends, and those shares will also appreciate. So if you sell those shares, you get more money for them. So I don't know how much more I can say about that, but
I mean, also
first company par value, those are some things you want to think about.
Early trains don't cost as much as late trains too. So you can put less in and get them moving and you get multiple trains you know, that cost very little, start generating you money. You don't need to put a ton into that.
Right. And then obviously, conversely, later companies, you usually need to par high because the trains are much more expensive later in the game in most titles. And parring at the same value that you parred your first company probably won't allow you to buy maybe one permanent train, but usually in that second or third company, you need to buy multiple permanent trains because you may not be able to offload that presidency, in which case you are liable to have that permanent train in one in each of those companies. So when you're parring your late companies, you need to make sure that you par them high enough to be able to afford often multiple permanent trains. So that's why that flow in full capitalization usually goes from low on your early companies and high on your late companies.
Cool. So yeah, the next type of capitalization scheme that we have listed is incremental cap. And so I feel like you said two broadly, and I'm assuming you meant to group one as full cap and the second as both incremental and partial, kind of.
No, I said two specific types and then one broad category, which is partial, is more of a broad category.
I see. Okay. So incremental cap games, which like 1846, are games where the company is capitalized per share sold. So the company will generally own the shares, and for every time you buy a share from the company, you pay it to that company, and then you get the share in exchange.
So when we first started playing, I didn't like incremental cap because it felt harder to me. You know, I only get money in the company for whatever I spend. So I need a lot more money to be able to buy these trains and stuff. And it didn't make as much sense to me. And I've since come around on that because I think incremental cap is actually really interesting because I think it gives you a lot more to think about when you're parring your company and while you're running your company. So the thing that I find really interesting about incremental capitalization is that when you buy or issue shares, it's all done at, usually, I guess I should say, done at market prices. So the later that you buy those shares, the more they have appreciated in theory, if you're paying out. So the fewer shares you buy early on in the game or the higher you par your company, the more potential capital your company can have. So you're not fixing the amount of money that company is going to have from based on your first decision like you are with full cap. And I find that to be a really interesting mechanism. So some of the things that I think about when I'm playing incremental cap is, first of all, how many shares do I want to buy? Because you don't necessarily want to buy as many as you can afford early on in the game because you're taking potential future money away from that company. And the company may not need the money early on in the game, but it definitely will need that money later in the game. So that's why you often will hear that buying shares in an opponent's company in a partial or in an incremental cap game can be an attack because you are basically taking away future value from that company.
Yeah, which is feels weird at first, right? In exchange for giving them money right now. You know, you're helping someone else's company do better immediately, but at the cost of late game performance.
Yeah. And you may not even be helping them. I think my gut instinct originally was, yeah, I'm giving them money. But we've, you know, like we talked about earlier with the, you know, excess money in a company early in a game is just money that sits there doing nothing. So you may be giving them money, but they might not be able to do anything with it.
Yeah. And what goes along with that is you need to play a game where you need to make your company appealing enough or potentially consider like, I won't be able to get what I want unless I get help from another player who buys my shares because I have a maximum of X percent of a company that I can buy. 46 has the problem.
Yeah, you can only have 60%, right?
Right. Yeah. So when you hit that upper limit, you're stuck if you have no other way of getting money into the company besides, you know, half capping or full withholds, which aren't, you know, you don't generally want to do withholding if you can help it, then you need someone else to buy those shares. So you need to be paying out well enough that it looked like a good investment to other players, which is a cool little game to play, making your companies seem good. And it's funny, maybe this is not a good decision, but I sometimes, between two different companies that look, you know, equally good to me, I will buy based on the history of the player. I'll be like, well, I know that this player usually ends up with some pretty good roots, so all things are equal here besides that, I'm just going to buy that person's company share. So, you know, there's a game that you develop, a meta game of between the players of that, who's a good company runner and who's not, and you get to interact with other players that way, which is cool.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I don't know that I've really made decisions based on who it is. I think I tend to try to analyze the map and try to figure out which companies are more likely to have more profitable routes early in the game versus companies that will end up with really good late game runs, because I probably will sell that share eventually to get money to buy, you know, to further capitalize my own company. So which shares will I feel less bad getting rid of later?
Oh, but you might not sell them.
And you might not. That's true. I mean, it certainly depends on the game. So, you know, all these things are situational, but I try to think about when I'm buying other companies' shares, which ones are going to make me the most money in dividends right now, not necessarily which ones are the best long-term prospects, and which ones am I going to benefit most from selling later. And that's not always easy to determine, and I probably get it wrong a lot of the time, but those are some things that I think about when I'm deciding who I'm going to invest in. I'm not necessarily looking at investing in the person that's going to run the best company by the end of the game, because it may not be the best investment for me short term.
Yeah, this is interesting, because I find myself playing in games where there ends up being like a couple of great companies and they're paying out tons. And, you know, in a game like 80 or 46 or something like that, 62 also has this, yeah, where there's just amazing companies at the end of the game and you just do anything to have shares in that company, I find myself trying to identify a lot of, like, spending a lot of my mental energy figuring out which one of the companies is going to be that one and trying to get shares in it early.
And, yeah, 1862, I think, is really nuanced in that sense, because mergers can kill your share value. So if you invest in a company that ends up merging twice, you may actually end up not having made a very good investment.
Yeah, that's true.
So I think sometimes 62, I think, is really tough when you're deciding what to invest in, because you can... You have to consider whether they're going to be merging, and there's so many other considerations. That 46 was probably a little more straightforward in that sense, although I'm not very good at it.
It definitely is
46 much, but choosing who to invest in 46 may be a little bit easier, I think.
Yeah, maybe. I think it is.
So we talked about par pricing with full caps. I want to talk about incremental cap as well. So I think par pricing and I think par pricing in incremental capitalization games is a little more nuanced than full cap. I think full cap is often par low early, par high later. Whereas incremental cap, I think that you have a little more flexibility to choose how you want to treat a company, because you're getting your shares are, and it also probably depends heavily on the title, but you're capitalizing per share bought. So if you buy 5 shares in a company at at $200, you're getting $1,000 into that company. And I'm just going to make numbers up here. But if you buy 2 shares of that same company and you part at $500, you're getting $1,000. So the capital, you have flexibility to get the same amount of money into a company in different ways, and that par price can have other impacts beyond the initial capital that goes into a company versus in full cap, that par price has one impact, financially speaking, not including things like operating order and stuff like that, which is the maximum money that company is going to get when it floats. So I think that, you know, for example, in 1862, when you start a company late and you have more money in hand, you can par it at 200 and maybe put the same as you would if you parted it at 100, but the maximum capital that that company is going to get is now higher than it would have been if you parted at 100. So that's what I mean by it being a little more nuanced. Any thoughts on that in terms of how to choose whether you're going to be parring high or low?
I don't know the strategy behind what is the correct answer. It seems like in a lot of games, you generally, if you have... Yeah, so I think if you want a company to be good long-term, you generally want to par as high as you can and buy as few shares as you can, but with the caveat that you're trying to get the operating order that you want and the granularity of you know, the right natural number to get the dollar amount that you're interested in getting into that company, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a numbers game. So if you get two shares at 80 to get $160, and then if you drop it down to 70, two shares is only $140, and maybe you need 150, so you can't do that seven. So you keep dropping it and seeing how many shares is it going to take me till I hit the next natural number for 150. So you're down to 50 now, and you buy three shares. You know, so it's like you said, it's very nuanced, and it's a cool little game to play. In my mind, when you were saying that, I for some reason pictured, like if you have a telephoto lens on a camera and you're walking towards someone and zooming out, you know, if you start zoomed in, walk towards them and zoom out to keep them looking at the same distance, but like the background changes, that feels like sort of the same thing as what you're trying to do with the par prices, is that you're shifting the value, the par price of the company and the number of shares. You're mixing those two dials around until you find the right number.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good analogy. And I think there are still, as much as I'm saying that it's more nuanced than full cap, I think that it does share some similarities in that you probably want to par, like you said, as high as possible to get that natural number with buying as few shares as possible, because you want to give it more potential capital. But where I think it shares something with full cap is that you probably want to make sure you're not putting excess money into it early, because you want to be able to put as much of your early money into shares as possible in order to earn dividends so you can buy more shares and snowball that money into more money. And I think that's where buying, you know, cross investing is a much bigger part of the game in incremental cap, because you really don't want to buy a lot of shares in your own company, because that's taking money away from that company. But at the same time, you want to have as many shares as you can get early on, so you're getting as many dividends as you can get.
Yeah.
And that's where cross investing is a much bigger part of the game in incremental cap, at least in the titles that I've played so far.
Yeah. I think that's a pretty healthy discussion on that topic. We got anything else there?
So one more thing about it, which is the whether or not companies can double, triple, or quadrump is really important too. Not only in setting your par price, but also in choosing whether or not to withhold, because in a lot of cases you'll always lose the dividends when you withhold, right? But other than losing the dividends, there's many cases in some of these incremental cap games where you can basically withhold penalty free, because you may drop back one, you know, maybe if I paid out in 1862, I'm going to triple jump. But if I withhold, I'm going to drop back one into my next turn because of the train that I just bought with that money, I'm going to quad jump. So I end up in the same spot, you know, share appreciation wise, I'm in the same spot and I've lost one round of dividends. But now I have a, you know, bigger, possibly even permanent train in my company. So I think looking at the stock market and how those jumps work is something that you should also do right away at the beginning of the game, in addition to looking at how you're going to get your permanent trains and the route you're going to want to run later. So
yeah, stock movement and appreciation is critical to all this stuff. So then the last group of capitalization schemes that we have listed is partial cap games, which encompasses basically any other capitalization schemes that we sort of haven't talked about. For example, 1880, where you get a half cap payout at float, and then half when 50% of the shares are sold, when you're all sold, quote unquote, in that game. That's a weird one. But like 1856 has, you get half, and then when you reach your destination, you get the other half, I think.
So it's not all, it's not all sold in 1880. It's when half of it is sold and the green phase is broken.
Yes, and that's why I said, in quotes, all sold, because that's sold out in that phase of the game.
No, in yellow, 50% is all sold. I'm saying in green, you become 50% sold and you get the rest of the capitalization.
Oh. 50% when you're sold in / after the green phase. Yeah. So this kind of game where you get chunks of money later, basically. Right. So in 1880, you get additional capital from connecting your foreign investor in. So there's some other mechanism to get dedicated money that's reserved in an escrow or something that gets released to you at some point. So in those kind of types of games, you need to be thinking about, what do I need to retain funds in order to achieve that, whatever that goal is. When will that money be coming? Will it ever be coming? Is it possible to get it locked out? I don't know. What else do you think about in these?
So I think this one is, since it's such a broad category, I think it's much more title specific, but just along the same lines of where's my money coming from? Where's it coming from? When is it coming? I think that's so title dependent, but it's, again, you need to be thinking about that. So in 1880, you know that at some point later in the game, after greens break, you're going to have to get 50% of your company if you want more money. You also know that you need to connect your foreign investor. And in 56, you know that you need to hit your destination to fully capitalize. And, we've only played a handful of titles, but I'm sure that there are other games that have unique capitalization schemes. And just knowing when, where, and how much money you're going to be getting, so that way you can, again, buy those permanent trains.
Cool. So then what else do we have here besides capitalization schemes?
Just along the lines of how you're going to get permanent trains. So a couple other things is it's not always going to be starting another company, right? Or even if it is, it's going to be dependent on a few other factors. So I've got a list here. So whether or not you can shuffle trains, like if it can you buy trains between companies? Some titles don't allow it, or some titles have limitations on it. Some allow you to buy a train over from minimum of a dollar to unlimited, and some restrict you to face value or half face value. So knowing what the restrictions are on moving trains between companies will inform you on how you're going to get permanence into your companies. So for example, in a game like 1830, you can start a company, par it high, put a bunch of, get $1,000 into that company, and you can take all of that money out of that company and put it into your first company and start buying trains, just by buying a cheap non-permanent out of one of your early companies. But in other games like 1862, you can't do that. You can only buy for maximum of face value for current phase trains and half face value for non-current phase trains. So you're not getting your permanent trains in by briefcasing like you can in 1830. And that's where, in that game, specifically, mergers are a common way to get new trains into your company, because you'll start a second company, use that money to buy permanent trains, and then merge it with a company that doesn't have permanent trains. Therefore ending up with one company with permanent trains.
Right. And CZ kind of does this in a way with acquisitions, where if you have a company that is about to lose its trains or has, if it's about to lose its trains and you don't want to buy something, you can start a bigger company and acquire that other company, depending on if you start the company in the right spot.
Yeah. And speaking of CZ, it's important to know if loans exist in the game, because that's another way that you could potentially finance your trains. And in some games, loans are a tool that you're encouraged to use, like in 56. And in other games, like 18CZ or 1824, they're a safety net. And when you end up having to take loans, it's usually because you're in trouble and you want to pay off that loan as fast as possible. So understanding if they exist and how they're intended to be used is important.
Yeah, this is interesting because it's, I'm gonna start a campaign to stop saying that things are interesting, because I think I say it too much. But there's a differentiation to be made here, I think, in that 18CZ and 24, Lonnie's titles often, 80 does the same thing, where in those titles, loans are a substitute for bankruptcy, right? Instead of going bankrupt, you get a loan from the bank. You're forced with a loan, as opposed to the optional loans in 56 or 61 or something, where if you want some more money, you can take it. And maybe that's a, you know, thing to be taken advantage of, a tool to use, or maybe it's a trap and you need to figure that part out for yourself. But I feel like Lonnie's games have a kind of a clear distinction when it's like, when there is no bankruptcy, and instead, because you suck at planning, you get free money. That's probably poison money, you know?
Yeah. I think in his titles, maybe not all of them, but in some of them, you can take a loan even when you're not going bankrupt in lieu of selling shares as well, if you feel that would be better for you.
Right. You can choose to not sell shares in a lot of them, so that and just take the payout from the bank. I feel like you do that when you owe like $10.
Yeah.
You know, and you don't want
to. Yeah. Like, if you have to sell a $150 share in order to raise $10. Yeah. You're probably just going to take the loan.
Especially if you own like tons of, you know, stock in that company. If you own 10 shares of like a really great company, you have to sell one of those shares and lose a ton of net worth just to make up $10. And yeah, you'll take the loan.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially if you're in, you know, if there's three operating rounds in, you know, two operating rounds to go or something, and that share is going to pay out multiple times, you know, you probably don't want to be getting rid of it.
Right.
So knowing loans, the terms of the loans, that's important. I put a little note here about short selling. I know it's unique to, I think it's unique to just the one game, 1817, but you know, that's a similar mechanism to loans where it's, you're basically getting free money up front, but you have to pay interest on it, essentially. I won't delve too much into exactly how short selling works, but you know, mechanisms like that, I'm sure there are other games that have unique mechanisms to raise money other than through dividends. So just being aware of what those mechanisms are and how you can utilize them, I think, is important.
Yeah, and then we just have a few more sort of miscellaneous notes, like identifying if there are bank pool limits in a game. If there are any, what are they, and what's the impact on that game, such as it might limit your personal liquidity if other people sell shares, or if you are still able to issue shares, depending on if there are, you know, if there are shares in the bank pool and there's a limit and your plan was to issue shares, well, maybe you can't because the bank pool is filled up. And those are tools that you can use to interact with other players' companies, right? If you foresee, oh, they can just issue shares and afford their thing, then you could buy some shares and sell them and fill the bank pool with it and use that as counterplay.
And conversely, you can use, like in a title like 89 or 30, you could actually use that to engineer a bankruptcy where you can still win because you can't sell shares. So you go bankrupt and then you end up with all these shares that you can't sell, and they count towards your net worth. And if your net worth is higher, you win. So I think it's probably difficult to pull off, but it's interesting that, you know, the bank pool being full is not always a bad thing for you if you don't have liquidity.
Yeah, I tried to do that once. It didn't work out. It was the longest internet stock round ever for me. Yeah, we've already talked about withholding, right?
And I guess we didn't. So I mentioned about, you know, potentially, you know, quote unquote, being penalty free by, you know, dropping back once and then quad jumping in the following OR. But there's a couple things that you should be aware of when you're choosing whether or not to withhold. And I think these may be obvious, but I'm going to talk as if we're all beginners. So How much of the company do you own? Obviously, the more shares that you own, the more costly withholding is. It's money taken out of your pockets. But if you're even on shares with other people, then withholding could have, you know, a net zero impact if everybody's got the same amount of shares or something like that. Also, in games where treasury shares pay the company dividends, factor that in. If you have a company with 8 shares in it, well, you're not going to gain much by withholding. You're going to get an extra 2 shares worth of revenue into that company, but you're already going to get 8 shares worth into that company. So just keep in mind, if that mechanism exists, keep in mind how many shares are in the company. And also, avoid withholding right before a stock round. I think that's basic advice that most people get if they're playing with experienced players. They get that advice early on, but it's worth repeating anyways, because that money is how you buy more shares. So if you're not already share tight and have the portfolio that you're going to have for the rest of the game, withholding immediately before stock round is probably usually a bad idea. And then the last thing is that some games have half pays. So be aware if the game that you're playing has it. For example, 1846, it's very common to half pay when your stock price movement won't be affected by half paying. So if you're going to move forward, if you're going to double jump, regardless of whether you full pay or half pay, it's common to half pay because you still get your stock appreciation and you're putting a little bit of capital into the company. You're, of course, giving up some personal money, but it seems to be a pretty common decision in 1846.
Yeah,
in games I've played.
Yeah, because you have one or maybe two companies that you're like trying to make do good, right? This company needs to do good, and that's a good way to get a bunch of money in there while still appreciating value. So,
right, and that stock appreciation is sometimes more important than dividends in some cases, because as we talked about, incremental cap. The stock appreciation is how you increase the potential capital in that company, as long as that company still has shares that you can purchase.
Right, for the next shares that you buy. So it's increasing more in the future as well. So that's all we got for our main topic.
And before we move on, not more about financing, but I'm just curious if you're listening to this, if this was helpful, any feedback that you have on this specific topic and topics like this. I'm personally interested in talking through some of this stuff, partially because I think hopefully it's helpful to other people, but I think it's also helpful and illuminating to talk through it in general for my own edification. So we would love to get some feedback on whether you like this kind of topic and what other topics you might want to hear us talk about.
Hear, hear. Edify us. So let's move on to our dividends. We are going to...
We're paying
full pay. I think we full pay.
Yeah, I mean we're definitely going to stream something this week. So, you know, 18DO is still on hold. Although we have talked about working on a way to, we don't know when we're going to be out of our houses playing in person again. So we're still talking about a way to do sort of a combo, like live map, digital charters and stuff like that. So we're working through some things. We might try to do something offline to work out the kinks and get that to you guys. But this week we will definitely be streaming Age of Steam on Wednesday night. This is normally our off week for 18XX. So I have at least one player, and if we end up with more, we'll just pick a map appropriate to the player count. And then we are also talking about trying to schedule an 1846 stream on Tabletop Simulator.
Yeah.
So we don't have a date or a time set for that one yet.
Right, but the Age of Steam would be Wednesday the 25th of March. Yeah. So, yeah, and Tabletop Simulator has like 30 18XX titles or more on there. And some of them, like this 46 implementation, the one with the GMT cover art, I guess, has a built-in like payout scripting. So you just put the run in, like how much you ran for, and it'll pay the money out to all the people. Digital chips and stuff. So that's kind of cool. And if you would really love like Title X to be on there and you are tech savvy, then look into creating your own mod. We know a couple of people who've already started doing that. I think Shazner and Dave McAvoy have both thrown their hat into the ring to develop mods for games that they want to play. I think Shazner's trying to work on 41, he said. And Dave's working on like
you are 1830 BC.
Yeah, the Splatter, like take on 18XX games. So we got what's our next episode listener question, Johnny? We forgot to come up with one.
That's your arena usually.
It usually is. Damn. Oh, I know. I thought of this before. I just didn't write it down. So obviously we are all kind of globally, more or less, I think globally, like confined to our houses. A lot of us are very social people. We're social people when it comes to playing these games, or at least addicted and willing to bear spending time with other people in some people's cases. What are you doing to maintain, you know, your gaming habits during this time? Are you playing on tabletop simulator like us, or just more asynchronous or synchronous board game, board A team or R18XX games? Are you just consuming more media or watching streams? What are you doing to stay sane, basically, as far as gaming is concerned? Or have you changed your habits in an unexpected way? Yeah, that's my question. Because I think we could all use a couple more ideas and encouragement to, you know, find new positive ways to get our energy out. So moving on from the listener question, let's go on to buying trains. And in this case, do we have any news before the train fact, Johnny, or shout outs or anything?
No, I don't think we have any shout outs. I can't think of any.
Okay. All right. So let's delve into the history, a little history. So a little prefacing here. I was interested in trying to look up sort of the heritage of one of the bigger name companies. So in this case, I chose the New York Central, the NYC, that is featured in so many of our games, because I know a lot of railroads at the point in time when these games focused on, and future ones, current day ones, are the result of a lot of small mergers, and a lot of games features, they feature mergers as a mechanic. And I was curious to find out about, like, you know, how these things came about. So we're going to talk about we're going to talk about the New York Central. So in 1853, Erastus, did I type that right? I thought it was Erasmus for some reason. Erastus Corning. What a name. He merged 10 railways across New York State to form the New York Central Railway, the railroad between Albany and Buffalo. Albany, not Albany, Albany. And it's helpful to understand a little bit of the geography of New York State, because without this discussion just ends up being a bunch of names. And I didn't really know the geography very well. And when I looked it up, it became a lot more clear. So it's helpful to know that there are a couple of large bodies of water that are important here. The Hudson River is the first one, and its largest tributary, the Mohawk River. So if you look at a map, and if you need to, and you don't know these places, by all means, go look up, you know, pause, go look up on a Google Maps or something to try and find the Hudson River in New York. So it comes up from, well, it eventually empties in the New York Bay. But from the New York Bay, the Atlantic Ocean there comes up, and it goes up to roughly Albany. I mean, it continues on to the Adirondacks, but that's sort of where the point of interest that we're interested in is to Albany, New York. It's basically just north. And its largest tributary is the Mohawk River, and that kind of splits off west at around Albany. There's a little triangle where the Hudson and the Mohawk meet of Schenectady, Albany, and either Troy or Cohez. Cohez? I figured out how to pronounce this before and I've forgotten it. So, doing good. Johnny, you need to unmute so that you can comment when I make mistakes like that.
It's not Cohoz.
Cohoz. It is Cohoz, I think. Great. So the other large body of water is the Erie Canal, which I've heard talked about a lot, but I didn't ever know where it went. So the Erie Canal ran from Lake Erie in Buffalo to the Hudson in Albany. So it connected Lake Erie to Albany, New York. And it runs basically east-west. It kind of slopes a little bit. So it goes east-west, and then it hits Albany, and then basically just goes straight down the Hudson to the Atlantic Ocean. And the Erie Canal is 363 miles long. So it's just basically a right angle, more or less, that connects the state. So that's important to know. So the New York Central that resulted in 1853 was essentially connecting the railways that were kind of dotted along a parallel route of the Erie Canal from Buffalo to Albany. So that included such smaller railways as the Mohawk and Hudson Railroad, which you'll, some of these names you might recognize from games that you've played. So the Mohawk and Hudson connected the Mohawk River at Schenectady to the Hudson River at Albany. And it was chartered in 1826. And it basically, it cuts off a triangle of those two rivers and sort of makes the route a little bit shorter. And it was conceived as a means of allowing Erie Canal passengers to quickly bypass the circuitous Cohoes Falls. Cohoes, God damn it, I need to know how to say this. Cohoes, is that it?
I have no idea. That's how it's spelled.
I'm going to get it. We'll get there. We're going to live Google it. God damn it. Cohoes. It's awful. Cohoes. I think it's Cohoes.
Cohoes.
Got it. All right. Anyway, back to the train fact. So anyway, it was, you know, cutting off this waterfall, the Cohoes shit falls, whose name comes from the Mohawk term for place of the falling canoe, which is interesting. I just said it again. Interesting drink. The other companies that it was merged from were the Utica and Schenectady Railroad. Jesus, I shouldn't have a podcast, huh? And if you listen to the names of these companies and you're looking at a map, you'll see like major cities moving ever further west, more or less. Some of these are interspersed from Albany to Buffalo. The Syracuse and Utica Railroad, which was chartered in 1836. The Utica and Schenectady was 1833 that I just mentioned. The Rochester and Syracuse Railroad was in 1850, and I had some heritage and a bunch of other smaller, like even these companies were merged from a bunch of other smaller lines that were like a few miles long. The Lockport and Niagara Falls Railroad. So eventually the New York Central did actually connect to Niagara Falls. And a bunch of other ones, 10 in total, the Mohawk Valley Railroad, the Buffalo and Lockport Railroad. And so that basically got them the east to the rest, east-west connection. And then separately, the Hudson River Railroad, which extended from Troy, which is basically right there at Albany, it extended southward down to New York City. And that company was obtained by Cornelius Vanderbilt in 1864. And that name, Vanderbilt, might be familiar to some people, even if they don't know railroad history. In 1867, Vanderbilt acquired control of the New York Central, and in 1869 he merged the New York Central, which was that east-west Buffalo Albany, with his Hudson River Railroad into the New York Central, and had the whole thing from the Atlantic to Erie. Although there was a little bit of railroad that was leased track between Albany and Troy, which is interesting, and I'd like to see games where you can like lease stuff. That would be kind of interesting. Interesting. Ah, drink. You unmuted.
Word of the day.
It wasn't until 1914 that another large merger changed the name back to the New York Central, because it was the, sorry, I actually forgot to say it. It merged to be the New York Central and Hudson River Railroad. So it actually got like a longer name and then later shortened it back up again. Fun fact for you 46 fans, the Cleveland, Cincinnati, Chicago, and St. Louis Railway, also known as the Big Four, was acquired in 1906 by the NYC, which operated independently until 1930. So the independent railroad was actually independent, and it seems like the canon way to play 46 is for the NYC to get the Big Four, but it doesn't always work out that way. So that's my train fact, is just sort of like all these different little railroad companies, railway companies who had their own little stories. And as I was researching these, you know, they all had stuff to delve into. And I was like, oh, well, this wasn't super interesting, but there's no like novel, like cool, oh, they dug up stuff and it was hilarious because of this or whatever. But just gives you a picture of how all this stuff got built up, because it was just these individual connections between towns and then getting acquired by bigger and bigger corporations. That's it. That's all I got.
Cool. That was interesting.
Drink. So I think that's all we have for tonight, folks. Thanks for sticking it through the very interesting train fact. And
yeah. And again, let us know if you like these kind of topics, not the train facts, but the finance topics and strategy discussions. And if you want to hear more of that, and if so, what?
Yeah. Send us ideas. And thanks. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, everyone.
All right.
See you next week.
Run your trains, pay your divs, and good night.
Good night.